Discworld. It's Discworld podcast analysis. Yeah.
So I'm Josh, and I am your unseen academical, and I am here, finally, for the second episode about 2001's Thief of Time, and today I will be talking about a bunch of books with literary connections to Thief of Time or historical engagements with the idea of time, including work by Lewis Carroll, Charles Dickens, C.S. Lewis, L. Frank Baum, Michael Moorcock, and Ursula K. Le Guin. Been a long time coming, and this was going to be the last episode on Thief of Time, or there was only going to be two. This is part two, and if you've looked at the runtime, you might notice this is a bit shorter than the episodes I usually do. That is because this is part of a larger episode that I've been working on and recording over the last couple of months. And as you'll see, this one is around, well, between 45 minutes and an hour, somewhere in there. And I still have 2 hours of audio to get through, which might edit down to something a bit more concise and manageable. But it is going to take me time to get through it all. It's taken me the better part of a week to get through just this first hour. And that's only gone through the section talking about the literary links and things. Overall, this second, or I guess third part now, is going to be focusing on a lot of big metaphysical ideas to do with time and its treatment in relation to philosophy and history and things. So big discussion points here. In this episode, or what's become this episode, I'm just discussing a bunch of books that have connections to the novel or ideas of time and things in them. There is some stuff in here that is setting up for what's to come in that larger discussion about time and things, but this stuff is perhaps more disconnected than the rest of the discussion, and yeah, I think can stand alone. So I thought rather than wait till it's all done, I could put this out as a bit of a stopgap to let you all know that I am still here. I am still doing this. I will give a more in-depth update about where I'm at and what's going on with the show and things after I get this next episode out, the part three, the final part on Thief of Time, that will have finished off the Death series, and I can talk about where I want to take things from there. I've got some things in the works, but yeah, we'll discuss that once the Thief of Time episodes are done. Anyway, you guys have waited long enough, so I will shut up and you can listen to me ramble about some books and things. So my first inclination when I was thinking about, you know, literary connections to Thief of Time and things was to go and give a whole history of time travel fiction, which isn't that relevant because, of course, in Thief of Time, they're not actually traveling through time. They do manipulate it a bit, but it's about stopping time and things. So I don't think that would be particularly useful. It's also made redundant in that this is exactly what Ian Stewart and Jack Cohen do when discussing Thief of Time and time paradoxes in The Science of Discworld 3. So I feel somewhat validated that that was their approach as well. But it also means that, yeah, there's not much point me rehashing that again here. I mean, it is quite a good and concise history of time travel stories that they list and explain in The Science of Discworld 3. So if you're interested, I do recommend that. But yeah, even though that's the approach they take and that's the approach I initially wanted to take, there isn't that much relevance to Thief of Time itself. I think perhaps the only real connection I'd like to draw is that while most modern time travel stories derive from H.G. Wells's Time Machine, from I think the serial was 1895, there were a few versions that he published before that. But in terms of time travel, science fiction, and time machines, most of it dates back to, as with most science fiction things, dates back to H.G. Wells. And then, but yeah, as Stewart and Cohen point out, the first modern time travel story, particularly science fictional time travel story, was actually written and published over 10 years earlier by an American writer called Edward Page Mitchell, who published a story in 1881 called The Clock That Went Backwards. And I've read this story. It's not particularly remarkable. This is a story about, like, literally it's a clock and you wind it backwards and time goes backwards. Fairly basic premise that would be borrowed over 100 years later by R.L. Stein for his Goosebumps novel, The Cuckoo Clock of Doom. But yeah, when I say modern and science fictional time travel story, like, there were earlier stories about people moving around in time and things, but these were always magical, if we think about, like, Merlin moving backwards in time and things, and even in a science fictional context, often sort of religious, people being shown visions of the past and future by angels and things. Like, this happens in two of the earliest science fictional post-apocalypse stories, being Mary Shelley's The Last Man from 1826, which is her only other science fiction book after Frankenstein, where the modern genre is invented. It's very good. I wrote a thesis about it. But there, the entire, well, not premise, but the framing narrative, the way that the character or even the reader is able to see into the future and see this post-apocalyptic vision is that the story, the book itself, was sent back in time, transmitted back in time somehow, and appears in the Sibyl's cave, which is a cave referencing that the Sibyls who are meant to, they're like seers who can see into the future. So the idea that was by somehow channeling or associating with these powers, then the reader is able to glimpse into the future. There's not actual time travel in that book, as much as I want to make the argument that H.G. Wells just ripped off everything Mary Shelley did, particularly in The Last Man. I mean, I think the actual premise of the time machine and War of the Worlds, there's a lot to be derived from The Last Man. But, you know, at points I've wanted to make the argument that, well, it's kind of the first time-traveled novel because the story itself gets sent back in time. But again, it's sort of by way of prophecy and things. And upon rereading, I don't think the actual book or the pages themselves get sent back in time as much as they are reproduced in this cave. Anyway, and then there's also an earlier book by the French writer Jean-Baptiste Cousin de Gainville, called The Last Man, which is a much more religious tale where angels are literally showing the reader the visions of the future and things by looking through a portal like the angels do in Milton's Paradise Lost and things like that. But yeah, what sets Wells's time machine and earlier Mitchell's clock that went backwards apart is that there's some kind of scientific mechanical construct that allows for actual physical travel through time and things. And while Wells invented a whole machine, which he doesn't describe the mechanics of, even though he does go into long monologues about four-dimensional physics and things to justify his machine. The machine itself isn't described, but it's a big contraption with levers and things. It's like a physical machine that you get into. What's interesting about Mitchell's version, as its name suggests, is that it's just a clock that if you move it backwards, which is, even though Wells's time travel, when you get down to it, is still pretty magical and not particularly scientific, the idea, the inference of some kind of scientific method or mechanism is there. It's a cognitive effect, as who is it who says that's what's important for science fiction? Not that it is cognitively sound, but it gives the impression that it is scientifically sound, which is what Wells is doing. What's interesting about Mitchell is it's just a clock that you wind backwards. So there is this connection between the idea that once you are able to record time, that you can then manipulate it. This is kind of a simulacra thing. It's the map being the territory that, you know, if you lift the map up and there's no land underneath, like in the Borges story, in Mitchell's story, if you move the clock, you move time. So the thing that records the time, the thing that is the representation of time, is identical or at least causally connected to time itself. And I'll look into some of the historical precedences for that later on. But yeah, this was a common or increasingly popular sort of idea from around the mid-1600s to the late 1800s, that the more precise you could record something, the more directly and minutely you could manipulate it. And obviously that's where we get to with Jeremy and the glass clock in Thief of Time. But yeah, looking beyond time travel and science fiction stuff, some perhaps more relevant examples of literature that deals with the idea of time and things include Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland from 1865, wherein the Mad Hatter is sentenced to execution by the Queen of Hearts for murdering the time of his performance of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. So as with everything in Alice in Wonderland, there's absurdist double meanings there. He's murdering the time that he's playing the song poorly, the rhythm is no good. But yeah, in the absurdist context of Alice in Wonderland, this is taken as he literally killed time. And in retaliation, time stops himself for the Hatter and his companions so that they exist in an endless tea time. Or at least that's the premise he puts forth when asked by Alice to explain his tea party. Maybe none of this happened and it's just the Mad Hatter rationalizing his broken watch. But if that's the case, then we're getting sort of an inversion of the clock that went backwards, in that the clock itself isn't having an effect on time, but the fact that time has stopped affects the watch, or the entire the Mad Hatter rationalizes that, yes, if his clock has stopped, then time must be stopped because one isn't a representation of the other. They are connected. We also get a few examples of this from Dickens that I don't think are directly invoked in Thief of Time and not as directly parodied as some of the other Dickensian things in the previous books that I've looked at. But yeah, it's interesting that this idea recurs a couple of times in Dickens. Most notably, we get Satis House in Great Expectations from 1861, wherein Miss Havisham lives amid the refuse of her failed wedding. The character Miss Havisham, she was stood up at the altar and therefore left her house decorated as it was the wedding day, because the wedding never happened. She could never move beyond it. So she always wears her wedding dress, and there is the decaying refuse of her wedding cake and all the tables set and everything that she never packs up. So she's stuck in this stasis, right? And I don't know if this is a really obvious sort of Doki Doki thing that I'm about to say, or if I am picking this up for somewhere of it, but I did genuinely think, if I'm looking this up, that it was Stasis House, not Saddest House. And I don't know if that's, it seems like it's an intentional misdirect by Dickens, but upon looking it up, I didn't really find any references to it or even people commonly saying that this is, you know, a commonly played upon thing. It just seemed like a couple of examples where other people had gotten it wrong and misspelled it. So I don't know if this is a common interpretation or I guess like a mandala effect thing, or if it's just the intended subtext and implication of Dickens' writing. But yeah, it's not Stasis House, even though that would be fitting. It is Satis House, which, as Miss Havisham explains, Satis, she says, is Greek or Latin or Hebrew or all three for enough, right? So it's enough house there. She's had enough, which, again, the word enough sort of relates to time, but it implies a finality as well. So yeah, there is that gothic imagery there. I mean, it's the coolest scene in all of Dickens, just because it's the most goth one. But if we're trying to trace, you know, some kind of vague Dickensian thread to these death novels, I think that is the most obvious reference for Thief of Time there. Although there is another one, a lesser known one, but keeping with Dickens, there is also Hard Times from 1854, which of course has time in its name, but also features the strict and overly rational school superintendent Thomas Gradgrind, who keeps time by way of a deadly statistical clock. So there's a bit of a, and I think this is intended by the implication of Dickens's word choice, that there's this connection between statistical and deadly. Like, it's deadly in that he's using this clock to enforce punishment and punctuality upon his students. But I do think there's some implication to the word deadly there, that it is precise as well. Apparently, Gradgrind's name, and I don't even know if I'm saying that right, is now used generically to refer to someone who is like overly rational and only concerned with cold hard facts and numbers. I have never heard this saying at all. I don't know if it's an English thing or it's an outdated thing. But yes, it would describe the type of personality that is perhaps predisposed to a very calculating utilitarian ideal that neglects imagination and emotion, right? Like, sort of gesturing towards the auditors here, who want to keep time by way of a deadly statistical clock. So perhaps an illusion there, more relevant to what actually happens in Thief of Time. But I haven't read Hard Times. I did try, and I just can't. I can't get through, unless there's going to be, you know, an old gothic lady in a wedding dress in a room full of spider webs and decaying wedding cakes and things. I'm not going to get through a Dickens novel, and I didn't get very far with Hard Times. But apparently, by the end of the book, he, of course, like Scrooge in A Christmas Tale, sees the error of his hard-lined ways, which doesn't happen with the auditors, except for, right, Lady Lejeune. This is sort of her character arc there. So maybe she is the true Gradgrind. Gradgrind? Is it Gradgrind? That would allude to the idea of school grading and grinding children up for their grades. But I think I'm just doing word association now. I'm not sure. Also, interestingly, about Hard Times, though, is that it is divided into three books. Book one, the Book of Sowing. Book two, the Book of Reaping. And book three, the Book of Garnering. So, of course, we're getting an allusion to death there with the reaping, but also by way of the reaper's association with the seasons and the flow of time, right? This Dickens book itself is set up as a progression of time with reference to the Reaper. So, you know, Pratchett being a Dickens fanboy is probably picking up a lot of what's going on here, but I don't know how much of these allusions, if they're there, would translate to a more modern audience who, as I've argued in the previous podcast, I think are primarily more familiar with Dickens through his more fantastical, gothic-leaning works like A Christmas Carol and Great Expectations. I don't know if too many modern readers from I guess the 80s and 90s, when Pratchett was popular until now, would be going back and reading Hard Times. We also have a continuation of the Narnian parallels that I've been tracking through the death sequence in the previous episodes. As I've discussed previously, Father Time himself appears during the Orphean Descent of the Silver Chair from 1953, where he's found slumbering underground. And then again, 3 years later in The Last Battle from 1956, where his awakening signals the end of time, whereby all of the protagonists, except for Susan, remember, are taken to the new, more real realm of existence, with Aslan telling them that the Chronicles were only the beginning of their story, which goes on forever. So we sort of have this collapsing of never and forever that I'll get into a bit later. Now, finally, of course, in Thief of Time, we have the reappearance of the Grimm fairy tales, which also play a role in The Amazing Maurice, which was published the same year. So again, Pratchett's sort of, his ideas are bleeding over between these books, along with the identity stuff. But yeah, following Witches Abroad. I did look into the fairy tale stuff. There is no glass clock fairy tale. It does seem like it should be something, but it's not there, at least not in the traditional Brothers Grimm or Perrault or Anderson fairy tale canon. The closest thing that I could find, though, is another link to my boy L. Frank Baum, author of The Wizard of Oz, who also published a collection of American fairy tales in 1901. These are just original fairy tales as far as I know, but he was making an American fairy tale canon. And this collection included a fairy tale called The Capture of Father Time, where a young boy and a cowboy in training named Jim uses his lasso to capture Father Time, who carries a scythe and an hourglass. So we've got the Reaper imagery there. But yes, as in Thief of Time, once time is caught, everything stops, right? He freezes time by lassoing Father Time. And he ultimately takes advantage of this situation to pull a bunch of practical jokes. So it kind of doesn't really go anywhere. But yeah, before he does that, Jim also has a debate with Father Time about the benefits of stopping time, arguing that because he stopped time, people will live longer, and therefore they should be thankful that he's improved their lives, to which Father Time responds that they wouldn't know it though, and their lives wouldn't be enriched. So here I see a gesture towards Pratchett's death in that, right, the auditors are saying what is best for the world is to stop everything and freeze it as it is, and that way everyone can be perfect forever, or at least orderly forever, I guess they're going for. But Death, like Baum's Father Time, says, well, the persistent perfection is not what's important. What's important is the changing. And that's sort of what, even though he's talking about knowledge rather than change, the idea that it's the experience that matters. We also have a moral included at the end of the story, in which Baum writes that this story should teach us the supreme importance of time and the folly of trying to stop it. For should you succeed, as Jim did, in bringing time to a standstill, the world would soon become a dreary place and life decidedly unpleasant. So I don't know whether Pratchett would have read this or not, but he might have, and while there is some sort of, you know, parallel development in just, you know, you follow these threads of the Reaper and time and things like that, you might end up at this same sort of idea and situation. But I do think it's interesting that Baum and Pratchett are preaching the same philosophy, right? They're teaching the same morals, that it's experience that brings pleasure, that brings worth and value to life. Now, there is another less obvious, although perhaps more significant, literary connection or potential influence that I found while looking into this time literature stuff, and that is British New Wave science fiction guru Michael Moorcock's 1965 novel The Final Program, which is the first of his Jerry Cornelius novels, wherein the titular spy is pitted against a brilliant mathematician named Miss Brunner, who wants to build a supercomputer so advanced that it can solve the final equation of human philosophy and thus perfect it. Moorcock is a huge name in science fiction. For people unaware, he was the editor of New Worlds magazine during the British New Wave of like the 60s and 70s. So much like Hugo Gernsback or John W. Campbell, as the editors of Amazing and Astounding magazine, sort of shaped the whole bug-eyed monster, space opera, dry scientific adventure fiction that we associate with that period. Moorcock is largely responsible for shaping the out there science fiction of the wave, which is where, you know, much like with music and films and everything, that drugs and sexuality and race and all of this stuff comes into it a lot more. Also, while not a household name, the way Tolkien or even C.S. Lewis or at least the Chronicles of Narnia are, Moorcock is somewhat of an obscure reference these days, or even at the time he was writing, despite his immense prominence and influence within the scene. But I think I'd say after Tolkien, he is the most important figure of modern fantasy, and that includes Lewis, George R. R. Martin, or whoever you want to throw in there, right? Moorcock is the reason why we have dark elves and tortured swordsmen and things. And sorry to get on the vampire thing, but this is like the Dracula to Interview with the Vampire contrast, in that everyone knows Dracula. Bram Stoker set the sort of blueprint for vampire fiction with Dracula. But everything that modern vampires do, the whole Byronic thing, comes from Anne Rice by way of Lord Byron and everything, but is popularized and derivative of Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, even though most people know Dracula as a household thing, whereas knowing the name Anne Rice and who she is and what she did, even though she's a pretty prominent figure, is a bit more of a niche thing. The same with Moorcock and Tolkien. Everyone knows what Lord of the Rings is, and elves and hobbits and dragons and things, but the kinds of stories, the way people behave in modern fantasy with the brooding swordsmen and the dark elves and all of that is pure Moorcock, right? His most famous character is Elric of Montalban, who is the waify Byronic swordsman with the white hair, and he's this weedy dude in contrast to Conan, and he has the sword, Stormbringer, which isn't just the name of an awesome Deep Purple song from the Coverdale era, but is the sword that feeds on the life force of its wielder and drives him to kill things. So this is this dark Byronic twist. But modern fantasy, this is what these characters are about. I mean, I guess it's already there in Lord of the Rings, and that's the entire premise of it, that Frodo is being tempted by this ring. But again, think things like the dark elves and Drist and whatnot is all Moorcock. But yeah, despite his prominence and influence, I'm not much of a Moorcock fan. I really, really like his ideas. Like, all his stories sound really awesome. I struggle so much to read his works. Like, they're incredibly dense, and a lot of it's implied. Like, there's a lot of Gene Wolfe comes out of Michael Moorcock, but whereas Gene Wolfe can be fun to read on the surface and is enriched by delving deeper, Michael Moorcock's books, I struggle to know what is going on. They're all very short. They're all like 150, 200 pages or something, but just following the story, I find, is immensely difficult, and I always find them very confusing. I've read like, you know, half a dozen of the Elric books, and I couldn't tell you a thing about them other than Stormbringer's a thing. So maybe I'll get back into those at some point, but I do just find them very difficult to comprehend even. And weirdly, Pratchett doesn't give much lip service to Moorcock's influence. Yeah, he's much more openly reverent of more mainstream authors like James Blish and Brian Aldiss and Arthur C. Clarke, I guess, is the big one he name checks a lot. Yeah, Pratchett actually only mentions Moorcock once in his Slip of the Keyboard non-fiction collection, and even then only in passing, right? He names him as the only person not wearing a sports jacket at the first science fiction convention he attended. And there are a couple more of Moorcock's convention antics detailed in Wilkins' Life with a footnotes biography. So that seemed to be the main way Moorcock stood out to Pratchett, by just being a bit of a weirdo at the conventions he went to. But Pratchett certainly knew him, which beyond his convention acquaintance, it was Moorcock who, as editor of New Worlds, published Pratchett's second ever published short story, Night Dweller, in 1965, which Moorcock praised in his introduction to the issue for describing space in a new and somewhat poetic light. In his biography, The Magic of Terry Pratchett, Mark Burrows explicitly names Moorcock as one of Pratchett's science fiction mentors, along with Aldiss and Clarke, although he also lists Moorcock alongside Robert E. Howard as one of the main architects in popularizing the trope of the gruff and brutal melancholy warrior stalking the land that Pratchett would so viciously parody. I think if he's lumping in Moorcock stuff with Conan, don't know how closely he's read it there or not. But Burroughs also notes Pratchett's loose acquaintance with Moorcock at the time of the Night Dweller's publication, calling the story the only of Pratchett's in 51 years that betrays no sense of humour at all, and remarks that it has a bleak and ponderous tone, although he concedes it also contains an evocative, chilly atmosphere that takes some skill to achieve. I have read this story. It's pretty bland. It isn't a comedy story. This is, it's a explicitly Lovecraftian story about a spaceship encountering Azathoth, the mad blind god at the center of the universe, essentially. I mean, that premise is kind of cool. This has given me some Event Horizon vibes, so I could be into that, but the story itself is solid, if not particularly memorable, but I think it's decent. I think it'd go well in like a collection of Lovecraftian fiction. But yes, it was, as far as I know, has never been reprinted, even in Pratchett's collections and things. So it doesn't seem like one he was particularly proud of. But yeah, in addition to his praise upon that story's publication, Moorcock also praised Pratchett in his 1987 study of epic fantasy, wizardry, and wild romance, wherein he calls the Discworld novels one of the few specifically comic series in epic fantasy, which he says sets out very successfully to lampoon the kind of sword and sorcery derived chiefly from Robert E. Howard, while complementing Pratchett's broad comedy and excellent farce. So yeah, again, positioning Pratchett as a response to Conan the Barbarian, which the early Discworld novels certainly are, but unlike Burroughs, right, doesn't lump himself in with that. So that's Michael Moorcock, if you don't know who he is. He was also a big old hippie who wrote like weird psychedelic science fiction, which is where, bringing it back full circle, the final program comes in, because yes, this is not his fantasy mode of writing. This is his more science fictional mode, probably his most famous science fictional series, which is, yeah, Jerry Cornelius, who is essentially Austin Powers, but actually from the 60s, and if he was a time-traveling super spy or something, although we'll get to that. At the start of the book, he's pretty much, he's just Austin Powers. And I did actually have a copy of this book sitting on my shelf that I found at an op shop and had considered throwing out multiple times because the name Jerry Cornelius didn't really mean much to me as much as, you know, I just grabbed it because it was a Moorcock book. And if you look at the cover art for this one, it's pretty full on. The version I've got, I'll post a picture of it in the notes or something, but it's there is a large-breasted woman. I think she's on fire and there's like a parade of people marching out from her into the water or something. I took this book to work and was reading it on my break for a couple of days before I realized that I was holding a book with just a big pair of boobs on the cover. So anyway, I had a copy of this book and so I struggled my way through the final program, and perhaps the reason why Moorcock is not a household name the way Tolkien or even George R.R. Martin has become these days is because there aren't adaptations of his work, like film and television adaptations, even though I think an Elric series these days would be pretty, the world is primed for it. I think that would be very successful at the moment. But the reason they don't exist is because there is one film based on Michael Moorcock's work, and that was an adaptation of The Final Program, which was produced in 1973. Now, this film is very hard to track down, even with all the boundless resources of the internet. But I did manage to hunt it down and watch it, and it is quite terrible. This is like heady psychedelic 70s science fiction on an extreme budget. Like they go through like a portal, sort of. There's meant to be like a trippy portal scene, and you know, in contrast to 2001 A Space Odyssey, where even the space gate sequence from that looks very dated with its just all these sort of screensaver filters and stuff now. This is 5 years later and they go into this portal and it's like, you know, at like a childcare thing or primary school, whatever, you get a big colourful parachute and you wave it up in the air and you run underneath it and there's all the colours and things. It's just like a flappy parachute or like a jumping castle or something. They go into a jumping castle with a parachute. It's pretty rough and the rest of the movie doesn't make up for its effects. But yes, Moorcock hated this film so much that he never let another one of his novels be filmed, which I think is being a bit silly and stubborn. But with all that preamble aside, what's important about the final program, apart from, so we have the idea of the Miss Brunner character is trying to create a machine that is so perfect that it is all-comprehending and will perfect humanity and philosophy. So that's how the book starts. But the novel ends with Miss Brunner and Cornelius merging into a single hermaphroditic being, which is just a thing that she is able to do. This is one of her powers, is that she can assimilate people into herself by having sex with them, because it was the 60s and Moorcock was doing a lot of drugs. And again, I'm not really sure about Moorcock's prose and plotting, but I think the idea is that it is they who are the complex supercomputer who now understand all of existence, and they become this time-traveling hermaphroditic god, which is all very 60s and trippy. But this is the end of Thief of Time, right? Thief of Time starts with the premise of there is a strange lady who shows up at this master clockworker's place and asks him to help her build a time machine, but the glass clock, a machine to control time. And that's what happens at the start of the final program. Miss Brunner goes and sees this scientist and says, "Help build this computer." And then it ends with the two characters who were at odds merging together into one being with power over time, just like with Lobsay and Jeremy at the end of Thief of Time. And look, Pratchett definitely read the final program, right? He knew Moorcock personally. Moorcock edited a bunch of his stories. So yes, I have no doubt, even though there's no record saying Pratchett read the final program, I think it would have been exactly the kind of fiction he was reading when he was growing up and as an early writer. And the plot, this profound plot of Thief of Time, much like with all with a lot of great modern fiction, is it's more or less just ripping off what Michael Moorcock was doing in the 60s, except yes, of course, making it far more intelligible and enjoyable. I mean, the final program also ends with the godlike hermaphrodite Cornelius Brunner blowing up his house and then commanding the policeman who shows up to try and arrest him to drop his pants, and then he spanks him on the bottom. So Pratchett did do away with that part of the story. Although, interestingly, in the end of the scene, I think it might even be the last line of the book, it says that both the Cornelius and their policeman's watches have stopped. So again, we have this connection between recording time and the manipulation of time itself. Something else Pratchett is perhaps borrowing from Moorcock here is that at this point, with the fusion of himself with Miss Brunner, that Cornelius becomes one of Moorcock's eternal champions, who are this sort of reincarnated hero or different incarnations of the hero across different quantum universes who are able to travel through and manipulate time and space. It's sort of the idea of the heroes of all of Moorcock's different series are some version of this eternal champion. Now, I wish I had Eden here to talk to me about this, because I think he is much more familiar with and knowledgeable about Moorcock than I am. I think he is a genuine Moorcock fan who could actually get through his writing. But to quote Eden from a post he wrote in 2020 for Heavy Bloggers Heavy, which is the music website that he and I both write for. I mean, he's the editor-in-chief. But to quote Eden from a post he wrote in 2020 about the appeal of Moorcock's eternal champion in metal music, wherein I will point out he did neglect to mention the Deep Purple song and the far superior Whitesnake version of it. Eden writes that, put simply, Moorcock's Eternal Champion saga posits a classic good versus evil conflict in the form of chaos versus order, but Moorcock puts an anarchist spin on it. These two forces fight for primacy among the multiverse. Both sides are beyond good and evil, but what if some force out there did want moral races, and especially humans, to be represented, and that force thought that humans were the knife's edge that would decide this conflict? In Moorcock's saga, this conflict is named the Cosmic Balance, and in order to thwart the efforts of both sides, of chaos and order, it chooses a champion to fight for it. And that is from a post called Maps of Meaning, Michael Moorcock, which I assure you is not a Jordan Peterson reference. So. Now, all of this might sound generic, but again, this is only because Moorcock put it out there. In Tolkien, there is, you know, this divine good that has been corrupted by the evil, and it then has to be set right by so that the order can be restored, right? And even though, like, we have things like Star Wars talking about bringing balance to the Force that is kind of aping this Moorcockian language, it's doing the same thing, right? Bringing balance to the Force just means getting rid of the dark side, right? That is heavily weighted towards the good. But I think we have a more truly Moorcockian interpretation in, well, I don't know about all of Pratchett, but in the Death Sequence and especially Thief of Time, in that the Auditors, as much as they are the antagonists, they are amoral, as Eden writes, beyond good or evil. And we do have an arbiter of chaos who ends up, right, and there's a temptation to say that Pratchett is pro-chaos because we end up with Roddy Soak and fighting on the side of the humans, but the idea that Death's preaching is that what makes existence worthwhile and what brings morality into the equation at all are humans, right? This is where Pratchett is very much a humanist, that humans are not only bring meaning to the world, but they bring justice, they bring good. This is this Sartrean existentialist thing that I was trying to get at in Reefer Man, is that in Moorcock's world and within Pratchett's writing, if not within the Discworld itself, it's humans who fashion morality through their actions, right? As Death says, there is no justice, there's just us. But yeah, I think we have a pretty definitively Moorcockian morality being reiterated in Thief of Time. But I guess Susan sort of playing the role of the Eternal Champion. One final incidental Moorcock allusion I wanted to sort of point out or suggest is I was looking into embodiments of chaos. Didn't really find anything useful, right? Chaos is not normally embodied in mythology. It's sort of this pervasive force, this nothingness that it is normally given consciousness or a personality the way it is in Pratchett. And one of the few embodiments of chaos that I came across and was already aware of is chaos from the video game game Hades, which I played a lot of while I was finishing up my PhD thesis. But as the Hades wiki explains, Chaos's symbol, which is five arrows spread out in a fan, is a reference to Michael Moorcock's symbol of Chaos, which normally has 8 arrows and has become a common symbol to represent the concept of Chaos, right? It's the opposite of, if order is a single arrow of determinism, Chaos is these 8 arrows pointing out in different directions. And apparently this symbol has been adopted by both Dungeons & Dragons and left-wing anarchist groups. I wasn't familiar with this symbol before, and I personally recognized it from the cover of the Swedish black metal band Kraft's 2005 album Fuck the Universe. So that's fun. They might have some dodgy politics, I'm not sure. But yes, that was sort of the one lead I had on Chaos that didn't go anywhere, but did lead me back to Moorcock, as a lot of things in Thief of Time seem to have done. One last literary allusion I wanted to explore before getting into some of the time stuff that I've ostensibly based this episode around is to revisit Ursula K. Le Guin. Now, in the previous episode, I talked about Le Guin and Taoism in relation to naming, but there are also some repeating ideas about time littered throughout her work that appear to be inspired by Taoism and the idea of unity. In Le Guin's 1969 novel, The Left Hand of Darkness, which is absolutely one of the best books ever written for the uninitiated, it is about an interstellar ambassador who visits the wintry planet of Geth, which is populated by people who usually have no gender, except during a monthly mating period where they develop either male or female reproductive organs, depending on how they're feeling at the time. This is sort of your 101 in science fiction and gender. It is built out of Le Guin's wanting to write a book where the first sentence was that the king was pregnant. Yeah, if you haven't read this book, you need to. It's great. But beyond all the gender stuff, the Gathenians believe that they exist at the center of time. And rather than numbering their years successively, they believe that it is always the year one. And the dates of the future and past years change accordingly each year, right? So I guess they have, you know, the year one, the year two coming, and then I guess maybe, I don't know, I was going to say the year minus one, maybe they have a BC thing. But they also have prophets who claim to derive their prophetic knowledge from being able to see everything at once, that time is compressed and eternal, which they call seeing whole. So this is all rather mystic, and again, it's being drawn from Taoism. But this idea of temporal unity again appears and is foundational to Le Guin's later novel, The Dispossessed, from 1974, which is also one of the best books ever written. I do believe it is Eden's favourite book, or one of his favourite books of all time, which is set in the same universe as The Left Hand of Darkness. It's essentially its follow-up, although there is the word-for-word is forest in between. But anyway, but in The Dispossessed is the story of the temporal physicist Chevek, who is a vegetarian, by the way, and perhaps the last significant utopian vegetarian. But anyway, in The Dispossessed, he develops an instantaneous communication device called an Ansible, which you may have heard of. This has now become just a trope of science fiction, that when you have some kind of communicator that can communicate instantaneously across space, like with spaceships and things, they're often called an Ansible, which comes from Le Guin's Dispossessed. This was taken forward and popularized in by Orson Scott Card in the Ender's Game series. His communicators in that book are called Ansibles as well, which I think within text they say was a word taken from some old science fiction book. So that's him knowingly paying tribute to Le Guin. I wish perhaps he would pay a bit more heed and tribute to some of her politics and morality. But yeah, this is essentially, well, apart from just gender exploration, sort of Le Guin's big contribution to science fiction. It's also the name of a science fiction newsletter that was edited by David Langford, another one of Pratchett's editors that he became closely acquainted with, and it was in this Ansible newsletter that Pratchett published his Why Gandalf Never Married essay, which I discussed at length in the Equal Rights episode, and which you might recall was directly inspired by Le Guin's gendered treatment of magic in the Earthsea series. But going back to The Dispossessed, Chevek is in part able to develop the Ansible due to his development of what he calls simultaneity theory, by which he asserts that everything that had happened to him was part of what was happening to him now. He says, "Where is time? Where is beginning or end? Infinite repetition is an atemporal process. The little timelessnesses added together make up time. So then time has two aspects. There is the arrow, the running river, without which there is no change, no progress or direction or creation. And there is the circle or the cycle, without which there is chaos, meaningless succession of instants, a world without clocks or seasons or promises. So again, we have this Taoist emphasis on change and things in opposition to chaos, but also the idea that time is broken up into these little chunks and instances that all exist at once. These ideas are also reflected in the dispossessed structure. The book is made up of alternating future and past chapters that lead back to the start so that the reader ends up where they began while experiencing the story simultaneously. I've read The Dispossessed a couple of times, and one time I did read it in chronological order, and I gotta say, it was not as good as when I'd read it back and forth. Not that the story wasn't good, but there really is that thematic jumping off of the different chapters. So I wouldn't recommend doing that. But yeah, and in The Dispossessed, we also have Shavek reflecting on how in myth and legend there is no time, and how mystics see all becoming as one being and understanding the eternal return. Which brings us back to this idea of fantasy time and how fantasy stories exist outside temporality and things that I discussed before. But yeah, the premise of The Dispossessed, or the scientific, the cognitive effect that I was talking about with the time machine here, is bringing this Taoist mysticism, mythological fantasy idea of the compressed eternal and trying to develop it into a scientific theory and application. So I think in contrast to the naming, this is less Pratchett being directly inspired by Le Guin in this case than him playing around with the same ideas that are derived from Taoism. But Le Guin was a huge influence on Pratchett, along with most of modern fantasy and science fiction. Like, she's probably third on the fantasy podium, you know, behind Tolkien and Moorcock. And apart from, I guess, aesthetic things and thematic things like the exploration of gender and stuff, her most significant and long-lasting gift to science fiction is the idea of the Ansible, which is directly derived from the Taoist conception of time that Pratchett plays with in Thief of Time. So yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. Okay, so that is it for now. As I said in the intro, this was sort of meant to be a part of a bigger episode and exploration, so not really building up to any grand conclusion or anything there. There's no through argument. It was me just talking about some books and connections and things that I found interesting. Hopefully you guys found something interesting in there too. Hopefully it was a fun little stopgap while I finish up editing the rest of the episode. I'll be back with that when it's ready, and then yeah, I'll discuss more about where the show's headed after that. Thanks for listening. Bye.
And we're clear.
Someone on the TV Tropes page, which I do think is actually where I picked up the reference to the final program, although there the writer calls it The Final Countdown. So for a long time I was looking for a book that doesn't exist, and I think they got confused with the Awesome Europe song of the of the same name. Yeah, someone on the TV Tropes page, perhaps the same writer, given their predilection for non-existent musical connections, claims that there is a soliloquy in Thief of Time wherein Death describes space as dark, deep, cold, and lonely, which they say is directly quoted, and now I am directly quoting from them, they say is directly quoted from a Hawkwind song called Space is Dark, which was written by Michael Moorcock. So yes, in addition to everything else I said Michael Moorcock was doing earlier, the other thing he was doing was hanging out with Hawkwind and doing a lot of speed and LSD and writing space rock songs. Hawkwind are they're space rock. They're like a hippie stoner metal band from the 60s, which are, I guess, most well known today because they are the band that Lemmy, the bass player from Motorhead, was kicked out of for doing too many drugs. But yeah, Moorcock did write a bunch of lyrics and things for, was an influence on Hawkwind. But as far as I know, there is no soliloquy about space being deep and dark and cold and lonely in Thief of Time. Also, the song is actually called Space is Deep, not Space is Dark, although a live version from the bonus tracks to Hawkwind's 2010 album Blood of the Earth is incorrectly labeled on Spotify as Space is Dark, which also curiously and completely coincidentally serves as an intro to another song called Angel of Death, which is a bit of an odd coincidence there. But yeah, this song does take some of its lyrics from the opening chapter of Moorcock's 1969 novel, The Black Corridor, but as far as I know, has nothing to do with Thief of Time, other than the general idea of space being vast. As much as I want to draw all these Moorcock connections, I don't think that one exists. And not to put, you know, a TV tropes writer on blast, but I did spend a lot of time looking into this just to discover that sort of every single detail of this claim was incorrect. So again, don't just believe what you read online, especially not on TV tropes.